In the 1930s, Stefan Zweig was one of the world's best-known, best-selling, and most frequently translated living writers, and he was quite prolific, the author of novels, short stories, biographies, nonfiction, and plays. His work remains popular in Europe, but his fame in the United States has most recently come because part of Wes Anderson's new movie, The Grand Budapest Hotel, was loosely inspired by his work. He left Austria in 1934, long before the Anschluss, but the life of an exile proved difficult for him, and in 1942, he and his second wife, Lotte, committed double suicide. George Prochnick's new book, The Impossible Exile, Stefan Zweig at the End of the World, tells his story in what the New York Review of Books has called a gripping, unusually subtle, poignant, and honest study. It's published by Other Press, and I'm very pleased to welcome George Prochnick to our show. Hi.
Thanks so much for having me on the program.
Can you fill us in on who Stefan Zweig was and to a great extent still is in Europe?
Sure. Well, he was born in 1881 in Vienna at a moment which was really the apogee of Vienna's aesthetic flowering. He describes a scene that happened, in fact, when he was still a child. The grand old major theater of Vienna, the Burgtheater, closed down in 1888. And he describes how all Vienna tried to attend this performance. And at the end of it, everyone rushed up to the stage and ripped off a floorboard and then preserved them in caskets in their home, like fragments of the Sacred Cross. So there was, he writes about the Vienna that he grew up in as really a time where there was a fanaticism for art. And he felt that this fanaticism of the spectators to encourage the artists made for the most profound artistic expressions. He then himself began writing as a very young man and was immediately embraced.
In the United States as well?
His work didn't really come here until much later in his career. He became, as you had said, by the 20s, the most widely translated writer in the world. And at that point, he was a bestseller here. He wrote these giant biographies that were huge hits. His biography of Marie Antoinette was made into one of the most lavish MGM spectacles of the 1930s and was enormously successful.
But today, people read his contemporaries still. Thomas Mann, Hermann Hesse, Joseph Roth is experiencing a revival of interest. But you don't hear much about Stefan Zweig. Was he very much of his time?
Well, this was one of the mysteries that I wanted to explore as I began to learn more about him and came to understand just how famous he'd been. I was baffled by this myself. And, you know, Zweig, there's an extraordinary essay that he wrote the first year he went into exile, in 1934. He was in London at the time, and there was a giant book exhibition. His own publisher in England, Desmond Flowers, had organized an exhibit of bestsellers from 1830 to the present. And Zweig describes wandering through these bestsellers and realizing he knows almost none of the books. And there are certain years for which they couldn't even find a single copy. And he actually describes this experience as very tonic because it reminds one of the arbitrariness of fame. And in fact, he says, you know, what makes for fame, and he had a wonderful humility, which is one of the things that attracted me to him. He says that one of the things that makes for fame is nothing to do with the lasting value of the work, but it is the power to galvanize the zeitgeist. And Zweig definitely saw himself as channeling many, many currents of the time.
And since he wrote so many different things, I'm assuming that not just one thing got him readers, and not just his fiction or the biographies.
That's absolutely correct.
To some degree, was his name on the cover a guarantee of having a bestseller?
At a certain point, I think it wasn't a guarantee because he himself wrote things that he was sure would be despised by the public. In particular, he wrote a book about Napoleon's chief of police, which he thought was such an unpleasant book, and the man himself so unpleasant that he told his publisher to cut by half the number of copies he wanted to print. But what Zweig says about fame that he valued is something that I think in a way resonates with what's happened today with social media, where he speaks about the way that fame for him was important because you build a community of readers who expect the best of you and whom you then want to make sure to absolutely compensate for their desire to be pleased.
So he was a celebrity author.
Absolutely.
At a time when there weren't a lot of celebrity authors, or was he one of many?
There weren't many, and writers of his scale, there were fewer still. And he had about him a glamour that many people commented on.
But he also recognized that he wasn't a novelist of Thomas Mann's caliber.
Right. He has enormous humility, and in fact, one of the most poignant and just sad descriptions in his memoir is when he talks about how he was glad to see his books burned with writers who he respected so much more than himself, Thomas Mann leading the pack. You know, he was constantly willing to grant these other authors something more than himself and to support the authors who were rising up and try to help them on their own career.
Did they all know each other?
Well, Vienna is tiny, right? And so I think that there was enormous overlap in the coffee houses and in salons of different sorts. But there was also incredible competitiveness in Vienna. And in fact, I came to see some of our mythology of Vienna as overlooking the ways that this competitiveness was, because of the claustrophobia, could be very destructive.
Well, he romanticized Vienna. Despite the fact that he had to contend with anti-Semitism, everybody did. It was there way before Hitler came to power. Was it different than German anti-Semitism?
Well, there was a joke that circulated in the late 1930s where someone remarked, you know, the Germans make great Nazis but lousy anti-Semites. The Viennese, the Austrians make great anti-Semites but lousy Nazis. The anti-Semitism... you know, certainly there are people who believe that there was a great deal of willful denial in overlooking overt statements of anti-Semitism, boycotts of shops around Christmas time because of the arch-Catholicism, particularly in the countryside. But I also came to believe that there, in a way, anti-Semitism was so pervasive that it may have inured people to the danger that this anti-Semitism could ever actually become dangerous. Rather than posing a threat, it suggested this is just the way it is, and culture goes on, and life can still be quite glorious.
One of the oddest parts of his story is that he wrote a libretto for Richard Strauss, who was one of Hitler's favorite composers, and he was the man who wrote the Olympische hymn, which was played in the 36 Olympics. But Strauss loved working with him.
Strauss did. And the story of their collaboration, Zweig writes about gleefully in his memoirs as the moment when he got to personally annoy Hitler. Because Strauss had insisted that Zweig be his collaborator on an opera called The Silent Woman, based on a Ben Jonson play. And proscriptions on Jews were becoming more and more intense. Strauss kept insisting that Zweig be allowed to work with him. The Nazi high officials kept searching through Zweig's work for something that they could object to and thereby put a halt to it. But in fact, the production kept going forward. The Nazis then at the last moment tried to remove Strauss's name from the bill. I'm sorry, Zweig's name from the bill. Strauss stood up for him. It was on there. It opened in Dresden and was an enormous success, was immediately booked in other cities, and I think within 3 days the Nazis shut the whole project down. But it had been something that had really gotten under the skin of people like Goebbels.
And Strauss wound up paying a price for his friendship with Zweig. He wrote to him, "Do you believe I am ever in any of my actions guided by the thought that I am German? Do you suppose Mozart was consciously Aryan when he composed? I recognize only two types of people, those who have talent and those who have none." And
this letter was intercepted.
And the Gestapo sent it to Hitler.
Right. But, you know, this, I think I want to linger for a second because one fascinating aspect of that collaboration is Zweig himself was criticized for this as well by Jewish groups. He said, "What are you doing with the person who's become the head of the Reich's musical operations?" But Zweig had a conviction that the real way you expressed opposition was by making something great as opposed to vilifying your opponents. So he thought the fact that the most important musician in Germany, the fact that he was working with a Jew, would ultimately reflect positively on the whole Jewish people. That was his hope.
My guest is George Prochnik. His book, The Impossible Exile, Stefan Zweig at the End of the World. It is published by the Other Press. Well, he refused to actually come out and criticize Hitler when he gave a press conference in London. There was a lot of pressure on him to do it, and it doesn't really make a lot of sense.
Well, particularly in New York, actually, in 1935, there was a big press conference where there was a conviction, especially among reporters from Jewish press, that Zweig was going to finally come out and stridently denounce the Nazi regime. But he instead preserves this incredible sinuosity throughout the interview, saying, "I'm just a writer, I'm not a politician." However, it's also important to remember that when Zweig resisted this kind of diatribe that he was expected to deliver, he wanted to appeal to the better side of the German people himself, and he felt that in 1935, 35, this was still not impossible. He also felt that the Jews who were stuck inside Germany were hostages and that anything he said vehemently might be used against them. And just on the side of that, it is the case that what he was trying to do over and over again was to say, look, even if there's a bad regime, the people themselves must value their cultural legacy. I'm part of that legacy. Therefore, if I can reach them directly, we can perhaps avoid the debacle that did ensue.
But his first editor was Theodor Herzl, who
That's correct.
Tried very hard, very early, to enlist Zweig to the Zionist cause, and Zweig resisted that as well.
Zweig was an anti-nationalist in every sense, and what he worried about with Herzl's project was that once there was a Jewish state, it would fall into the same traps of a military and all the patriotic symbols that he loathed so intensely in the German-speaking world. And ultimately, he thought that while he didn't have a better solution, that Herzl's solution was going to repeat the errors of Europe in the Levant.
In the time that we have left, let's talk about his living in exile. He didn't leave Austria the way many of his compatriots had to. He left rather comfortably and continued to maintain a passport. He left before, way before Anschluss. So he left for other reasons, or did he sense what was coming?
I think primarily the latter. One phenomenon, a historical moment that's not widely studied here is the civil war that took place, a very brief civil war in Austria in 1934, where the left was essentially destroyed by what was then described as a kind of clerico-fascist government, not a national socialist government and not an especially anti-Semitic government, but still a right-wing government. Zweig was caught up in events related to that civil war. His house was searched for guns that the state believed he might be harboring for the left resistance. And in fact, he was so horrified by the idea that he, this ultimate pacifist who lived on a hill above Salzburg in the most visible possible position, might be imagined to be storing guns, that he felt, I have to get out of here.
But he was able to sell his house and his collections of old manuscripts.
Well, critically, his then-wife, Friederike, stayed behind, and their marriage had also been disintegrating for some time.
Well, he was having an affair with his personal assistant or whatever.
One of many affairs, yes. And Friederike had been trying to get him to stay in Salzburg and, you know, sort of said, but, you know, Zweig is friends with the mayor. He's friends with all these high people. What does he care about this anti-Semitism? But Zweig writes very poignantly about what it was like to walk the streets of Salzburg and have people he'd known for 15 years turn away from him and look at shop windows.
Well, he continues to write bestsellers, comes to New York, doesn't like New York, and moves to Brazil, where he continues to write bestsellers. He's now married to that personal assistant, Lotte. People were shocked when he committed suicide. Thomas Mann called him a coward.
Right.
There doesn't seem to be any real logic behind him killing himself under these circumstances. He seemed to be happy in Brazil, where they feted him.
You know, let's go back for a second to that interview that he gave in 1935. He upset many of the reporters then by his refusal to come out with this strong statement against the Nazis. One of the reporters, Joseph Brainin, who went on to cover the Rosenberg trial, decided he had to interview Zweig again and get the story straight. And when he spoke to him a second time, he described how when Zweig spoke about the moment when Europe was split up into little cubicles, he felt like he was watching someone describe their own physical dismemberment. Zweig identified so completely with the continent that I think, although he did believe that the Nazis would be defeated, his sense that these ideals he had worked for his whole life of pan-Europeanism and pacifism had been destroyed, and he was tired. He was 60 years old. He didn't see how he could start his life again.
And he also feared that the Nazis would follow him into Brazil.
He did have those fears. And it's important to remember that Vargas, the dictator in Brazil, did not firmly ally himself with the Allies until after Pearl Harbor, which was 2 months before Zweig's suicide. So the situation politically in Brazil was complicated. Vargas was a dictator, although a very complicated one, who also helped enfranchise the workers, for sure.
Well, it could have been worse. He could have gone to Argentina.
That's correct.
So at the same time, he continued to sell.
Yes.
This has obviously nothing to do with the kind of despair we have seen with some other writers who killed themselves at this time.
No, but when we talked earlier about his fame and his sense of a community that was expecting his work and for whom he wrote, that community was the German-speaking world within Germany and Austria. That was really the public that he imagined himself to be creating his work for all that he was an intense European cosmopolite who absolutely loved Paris, etc. So while he didn't have those despairs, he had the despairs of feeling that his core public was gone and that the culture he loved most had made him a criminal and had literally burned his books.
Now, for listeners who have not read Zweig, which of the books do you suggest?
Well, within his fiction, I encourage everyone to look at Beware of Pity, which is a strange and disturbing but marvelous story of a young cavalry officer who, for a very minor faux pas, ends up getting into a snowballing circumstance where he tries to ask a disabled girl to dance, who's the daughter of a rich man. She can't dance. And from there, it's amazing how the whole world unravels in which this officer lives. Zweig had this definition of pity, which was on the one hand, well, I think we may be running out of time here.
Well, I want to tell everyone that you'll be in conversation with Paul Holdengraber at the New York Public Library tomorrow at 7 p.m., and then chat with Rebecca Mead and Wayne Kustenbaum at the Powerhouse Arena in Dumbo on Wednesday. More information on our show page at WNYC.org. The book, The Impossible Exile, Stefan Zweig at the End of the World. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.